You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists have predicted how hot Earth can become, depending on our greenhouse gas emissions, of course, but they seldom say how quickly that happens, or how it will develop in the region where you live. As biologists can tell you, when it comes to survival of the species, the rate of warming may be as important as the final temperature. What's true for animals and plants is just as true for humans and our ability to adapt our civilization. Speed matters. That's why I welcome a new paper titled Near-Term Acceleration in the Rate of Temperature Change. The lead author is Dr. Stephen J. Smith, a past author with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and currently a scientist with the Joint Global Change Research Institute of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Maryland. That's part of the U.S. Department of Energy. He joins us now. Stephen Smith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
Steve, how would you introduce your paper to an educated listener?
Well, we looked at how fast temperatures change over time due to both human and natural influences, and we focused this work on the rate of change over 40-year periods. So what that means, if you looked over four decades of data, what was the average change over that whole period? And the reason we focus on that time period is that, you know, temperatures in any particular place, say here in North America, vary from year to year due to internal variations in the climate system. And I suspect most of your listeners heard of La Niña, El Niño, and so on. And so by looking over a longer time period, we found we could look beyond the immediate impacts of the shorter-term fluctuations and see what was going on in terms of a slightly longer-term trend.
So most scientific models focus on how hot the Earth will become as the global mean temperature increases. Why should we be just as concerned about the rate of increase?
Well, the rate of increase tells us how fast we would have to adapt to any changes. So one example that people might be familiar with is growing zones. So there's organizations that put out these zones that tell you, give you some indication of what types of plants are suitable for your climate. And, you know, for example, in your yards or orchards or gardens. And the rate of temperature change, if this is changing, this tells you how quickly these zones are going to shift. And if these shifts occur faster, we're going to have to adapt to those shifts more quickly. That also applies to human systems. So, for example, if the climate changes, different crop varieties or different crops might need to be planted by, you know, any particular farmer on their land because they can't move their land. Their land is there, and they're going to have to adapt to whatever changes happen. And in the United States, of course, we have some pretty smart farmers who can adapt to changes, but they also have a lot of information and resources available to them, agricultural extension, a lot of information and technology. But a particular concern as climate is changing are, for example, farmers in poorer countries. So they don't have these resources, so it may be much harder for them to adapt to these changes.
Is it fair to say that your research shows the rate of temperature increase is speeding up, that we will get hotter faster?
Yes, what we found is these climate models project that we're on the cusp right now of a new state of climate where the models are projecting that the rate of change will soon start to speed up and be outside of the range that we saw historically. So what we see, to get to the other part of your question, is that looking at these sort of four-decade periods, that the rate of change sped up over the last several decades and then flattened out over the last few years. So looking at the past 40 years from today, for example, temperatures have still increased, but at a relatively constant rate over the last few segments of time. But that rate's also getting close to the high end of what we've seen historically already.
So what is the baseline you use to compare current rates of warming?
Well, that's a good question, and you need to have something to compare with. And we did a couple things. We looked at one of the big things we looked at was reconstructions of temperatures over the past 1,000 to 2,000 years. So I think maybe you've talked about this on your show before. These are produced using proxies from a lot of different sources, tree rings, layers of coral reefs, ice cores, stalagmites in caves, and so on. And this gives us some estimate of what sorts of rates of change naturally occurred in the climate system. And it also tells us something about what sorts of rates of change humans and ecosystems have had to adapt to in the past.
So, Steve Smith, other forecasts like the IPCC tend to look at climate developing over a century. That's a pretty long time. How was your team able to get a snapshot of what might happen in 40 years? And that's a time frame that seems more real for humans.
Well, we really used the same data as used by other scientists, but we just looked at it in a new way. And what we found was it was hard to distinguish the human-driven trends from natural variability if you looked at rates of change over, say, a two-decade time horizon. But once we got out to a 40-year span, you could see these changes come out up above this natural variability.
And what is the range of possible heating your paper predicts for the next 40 years?
What we found, for example, in North America was that in the near term, the model showed a range from about 0.7 to 1.8 degrees centigrade over a 40-year period up to about the near term, and that's about 1 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit over that period.
That's quite a bit because we were trying to stay under 2 degrees. We've already warmed almost 1 degree. If we get 1.8, we're over the safe limit.
Well, that 2 degrees refers to 2 degrees of, or what people often talk about is 2 degrees of global temperature. But regional temperatures, say in North America, the northern hemisphere tends to warm a little quicker than the Earth as a whole. So that's, but it's getting closer, it's true.
Okay, now how does what you've predicted compare to the past 1,000 years of Earth's temperature as we know it?
Well, over the past century or two, what's happened is temperatures sort of fluctuate. They go up and down. So looking at the past 1 or 2,000 years, looking at these reconstructions, what we found was regional temperatures in, say, Europe and Asia and so on would fluctuate. They would go up or down maybe 0.8 degrees or maybe up to maybe a degree over a 40-year period. But what was happening is sometimes it would go up, sometimes it would go down, and there was not a lot of roughly equally likely over that period to get rates of increase or rates of decrease.
Is there any way that you could address uncertainties like the possibility, say, an economic collapse which slashes fossil fuel emissions or a big cut in urban air pollution resulting in global dimming and maybe a rapid jump in temperatures? Can you factor those things in?
Well, we can. What we do for those sorts of things is we look at different scenarios of the future. So when we look at the human system, which is what you're talking about, we don't say we can predict the future. You know, there's no physical laws that govern what human beings will decide to do or how technology will develop. So what we do is different scenarios. So these scenarios actually all included decreases in air pollution in these scenarios. So what we assumed was that as countries' incomes go up, then they would pay increasing attention to cutting air pollution. So there wasn't a sudden decrease, but it did decrease over time. So that factor is in there. We don't have a scenario that is some sort of economic collapse. That sort of scenario is not very common for people to try to do, although we did look at a scenario where greenhouse gas emissions were cut very significantly over the next decade, even over the next 50 years. So that's sort of a low-end scenario of what would happen in the future. So we did look at a range of possibilities.
Okay. Now, new science has emerged pretty recently predicting that heat sinks like oceans and forests may not function as well in the coming decades. Do the climate models you used factor this in?
Well, these types of effects in general were included in the CO2 concentrations that were used to drive these models. Now, these models, the design of the scenario process was such that they all use the same carbon dioxide concentration pathway. So there's uncertainty in exactly these things that you're mentioning. So it's possible that the effects could be somewhat higher or lower than the central result, depending on how these things play out. We didn't try to estimate that, but I think it would have a more impact further out in the century because these feedbacks tend to be sort of accumulate over time. So I wouldn't expect the differences in the assumptions about CO2 feedbacks to have a large impact in this near-term rate of change that we were focusing on.
Another point that you raised in the paper is that regions do matter. In fact, in the paper, near-term acceleration in the rate of temperature change, we find this quote, although global temperature trends are the most commonly used metrics of climate change, climate impacts will be driven by regional trends. Why do regional results matter as much or more than global forecasts?
Global trends are a useful metric to think about how much change is happening, and this 2-degree number you mentioned has, you know, in a lot of people's minds. But it's really the trends in specific locations that are most relevant for impacts, because that's where the impacts happen. So by looking at regional trends, we're a step closer to where people live or where our forest or croplands are that will be experiencing these changes.
You already told us about the effects in North America, possibly. What about Europe?
Well, Europe was actually fairly similar to North America, and this is a general effect that the Northern Hemisphere, you know, climate tends to happen in these, in the hemispheres or latitudinal bands. So North America and Europe were fairly similar and both above the global average, and that's a general effect that we've known for some time.
And speaking of above the average, the Arctic is already fantastically warmer the past few years. Will it get even warmer even faster?
Yes, that is something we saw in the Arctic, and it was rather striking that the model showed a range of about 1 to 3 degrees centigrade over 40-year periods over this near term, and even higher rates in the following couple of decades. So it was quite large.
What are the predictions about warming rates in the other hemisphere, in Australia or New Zealand, for example?
Well, I have to say, I didn't pull out the numbers for Australia. We were focusing on comparing with these long reconstructions for the past, and it so happened we didn't have one available for there. But the southern hemisphere in general tends to warm at a slightly lower rate than the global average, and it's the opposite of the northern hemisphere. And that's because most of the southern hemisphere is ocean, so you have more buffering effect with the ocean stabilizing temperatures and more of that heat going into the ocean. Conversely, the northern hemisphere has more land mass, and that land doesn't really absorb heat, so that land mass tends to heat faster. So there's this general difference between time scale of response between the northern and summer hemispheres.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, scientist Stephen J. Smith from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Maryland. We're talking about the speed of temperature increase on planet Earth. Steve, as is common for such scientific projections, your team calculated a range of possibilities. What would you say the best case scenario is, and then what is the worst case?
That's another interesting question, and let me just give a little statistics. What we did is we showed the 90% range over the climate model. So over this set of climate models that all ran this scenario, we showed the results that happened, the range of results that happened 90% of the time. So there are some results that happened outside of that range, and I think that might be sort of this best or worst case. And we didn't really look into those. We did this 90% range because that we wanted to present a range that we considered fairly robust. So if you wanted to get into this consideration of the best and worst case, then what you need to do is look at those smaller number of scenarios that were outside this range where most of the models were. You need to carefully evaluate how realistic those scenarios are, what the mechanisms were that resulted in that either much better than average or much worse than average result, and then probably also consider how well those models simulated the historical period. So we actually didn't do that, but it's an interesting question.
I noticed in your paper it discusses what happens under a rate of change of 4.5 watts per meter squared, and to be honest, that's not easy for any of us to understand. What does that mean, and who is using that standard?
Right. Well, that's good. So what this scenario is, it's a standard scenario. So what was done was a set of four scenarios were developed for all the climate models to run. And this particular scenario we took as a case we focused on, but as I mentioned, we looked at some other ones as well. And so this is a scenario that refers to radiative forcing, and that's something measured in watts per meter squared. So first I have to talk about that. So radiative forcing, what this is a measure. It's how much extra heat that our changes to the atmosphere are trapping in the Earth system. So if you look at the top of the atmosphere, how many watts per square meter, that's like watts like a light bulb. So how many watts per square meter are being trapped? Now, 4.5 watts per square meter, that's a scenario that stabilizes at that much extra heat being trapped by the end of the century. And it doesn't sound like a lot. It's actually a fairly small number, except when you integrate that over the whole of the Earth, that's enough to change our climate quite significantly. So that's what that is. So it's a scenario where it was assumed that the world takes action to control carbon dioxide emissions, and that carbon dioxide emissions stabilize, they peak about in about 20 years from now, and then they go down such that by the end of this century, by 2100, global CO2 emissions are, I think, half or a third below what they are today. So we've taken some significant actions to change that trajectory.
Now, what about the recently observed slowdown of warming? Does your research predict that? And if not, why not?
That's another good question. So first, we can talk a little bit about this slowdown. So as you implied, if we look at the global surface temperatures, the records generally show that the surface temperatures have increased over the what they were, but they haven't been increasing very much over the past several years. And there's a lot of research going on in this slowdown, what's causing it. And we still have a fair bit to learn, but in my reading of this, there seems to be a bit of a developing consensus on a couple of things. One thing, we're certain that we're still adding extra heat to the Earth system. Greenhouse gases are still accumulating. But a large part of what happened lately seems to be that this extra heat is going into the oceans and deeper into the oceans. So instead of this extra heat heating up near the surface, it's ending up deeper in the oceans. So the question is really, why is this happening? And this is something that, like I said, a lot of people are really looking into this, and I don't think we have a complete answer yet, but there's increasing evidence that this is, at least in large part, somewhat a chance event. For example, a chance combination of some of these different modes of variability. So there was a recent paper on this that was looking at that. So to circle back to your original question, if this is a chance event, we've got these modes of variability going on that are happen to be drawing extra heat into the ocean instead of letting it go in the atmosphere, then when you run a climate model, when you get that model gets to 2015, then there's not much chance it will have one of these events right in 2015, you know, at the right time, since it's just a chance thing. So when people look at longer climate model runs, they do see this sort of slowdown so that these things happen. So what we need to understand is understand the mechanism behind this and understand what the probability is. Is this a 1 in 100 type of event? Is this something that happens more often, less often? And then we will be able to put this in the context of these results and these probabilities.
Another key point I found in your paper is the concept that as this century progresses, the human fingerprint on climate change becomes easier to see. Right now, we have a hard time seeing that a certain violent storm or heat wave is due to human emissions rather than the natural cycles or variations you've just talked about. Will that become clearer by 2040 or 2050?
Well, that's really a question that's really a leading research question in climate science, and it's really a question about attribution and probabilities. And you're asking, you know, how can we say what caused a certain event? And the way most of us tend to think about this is that what we would want to be able to say is that what was the probability of this event occurring before humans started changing the atmosphere, and how much did that probability change? You know, it could go up or down. And I think a lot of this, I think we'll get increased knowledge of this, but also the statistics might change. So what's happened is there's work that's already going on for heat waves. So this is where we're starting to be able to do a little bit of this, where people are trying to estimate what the probability of a heat wave occurring and if there was an increased probability due to climate change. So we're just starting to be able to do this. And I think heat waves will probably be an area where we'll be able to do this the easiest. We have more data. We have these long, you know, millennial records to look at. Doing this for storms is more difficult, so it might take a little longer for us to be able to understand enough to be able to do that, answer your question.
In most cases of science, we do need a baseline, a standard case to detect real changes. I'm guessing from your conclusions that the science of what is normal is still being developed, or is there a normal in these natural systems?
Well, it depends what piece you're looking at. So, for example, for the surface temperature, we do have these long records, which gives us a lot more, really a better idea about what, you know, what normal might be. And it does fluctuate. But what we're able to do with those records is get a sense of how much they fluctuate. And I might mention one of the first things we did in their paper was we compared those records of fluctuations with what the climate models did, and they agreed fairly well. So that gave us more confidence in what the climate models are doing. So for temperature, I think we can have a fairly good sense. But for something like rainfall, it's a lot harder. Rainfall is more sporadic. It's actually harder to measure today. There's places in the world where we actually don't have good measurements of rainfall. We certainly don't have good measurements over as long of time. So I think understanding what's normal for rainfall is a little harder.
Can I assume from this paper that climate change will be an increasing problem for the foreseeable future, a kind of project that lasts for centuries?
Well, at least through the 21st century, yes. It's going to depend on what humans decide to do, how long it goes after that.
So I guess we're such a great variable that it's difficult to say what the state of the world climate might be in 2200 or 2300. Can we go that far ahead yet?
Well, we can do projections, but as you said, the uncertainties get bigger. And the uncertainty in what humans will be doing certainly is a big piece of that. And, you know, if emissions keep increasing, you get increasing uncertainties on how the system will respond.
Biologists have been saying for decades that the rate of change is key. I've had them on this program saying that. Plants and animals, insects can only adapt so fast. So why has it taken climate science so long to really address this work?
Well, I think people have done it indirectly before. I can really only speculate, but I wonder if it might be a gap between there is a community of people that are looking at impacts now. So they're looking at what's here and now, like many of the biologists you've talked about, looking at how species are shifting and observing that. And then there's people that try to model what's going on in the future, and often that modeling has been focused on further out in time so you could get a better signal. And yeah, I think in general people are starting to bridge those gaps, and I certainly hope our work can help do that as well.
Steve Smith, these scientific papers take quite a while to research, review, and publish. I'm presuming you've moved on. What are you researching these days?
Well, I'll just mention one project, which is we're working to develop more up-to-date estimates of historical emissions of things like aerosols and pollutant emissions. And this is a pretty exciting project for me because we're bringing together researchers and data providers from around the globe to improve our understanding of our emissions into the atmosphere and how humans have been impacting the environment.
We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen J. Smith from the Joint Global Change Research Institute of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Maryland. The new paper, Near-Term Acceleration in the Rate of Temperature Change, was published in the journal Nature Climate Change on March 9, 2015. Steve, thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find links to the science we've been talking about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.